Hello. In Europe, by about 750 AD, the wave of Islamic conquest had peaked and then been stopped in the west, roughly along the border between modern Spain and France, and in the east, at the formidable defenses of the Byzantine Empire. Politically, Europe now consisted of dozens of smallish kingdoms ruled over by various barbarian peoples. One of these nations was a group known as the Franks, from whom the modern country of France got its name. And during the 4th century, they had settled in what would eventually become France, and at least at that point, there was very little to differentiate them from dozens of similar northern barbarian groups, other than that perhaps the Franks had a predilection for fighting with axes, and they seemed to like to wear striped clothing. In the 5th century, one of their kings, Clovis, had converted to Christianity, and he had managed to unite all the various tribes of the Franks under his leadership. Out of the multitude of barbarian kingdoms and clans milling around Europe, it would eventually prove to be these Franks who would give rise to the first great empire of the Middle Ages. The Franks had a series of strong kings who aided their rise. And among these, the most important dynasty was named the Carolingians. And of those kings, the pivotal figure was a man named Charles the Great, or in Latin, Carolus Magnus. Now, he is, of course, most familiarly known today as Charlemagne, which is a corruption of the Latin form of his name. There have been many rulers who have gotten that epithet of the Great stuck onto their names, and they haven't always deserved it. But Charlemagne did a number of important things that I think fully justify its use in his case. So let's look at his actions in four key areas: war, politics, religion, and culture. First of all, Charlemagne was an effective warlord. He expanded the borders of the Frankish Empire. And nearly every single year of his very long reign, he would lead his troops out and push those frontiers a bit further. Unlike many of the great empire builders that we've studied so far, such as Alexander or Chandragupta, Charlemagne did not suddenly annex huge territories through enormous set-piece battles. Instead, he practiced a kind of incremental warfare, in which he would identify a relatively limited goal for each campaign, and then he would focus on acquiring just the targeted area and consolidate it firmly into his kingdom. So rather than an empire built up by a small number of big dramatic victories, each of which resulted in huge territorial gains, Charlemagne's strategy was one of doggedly nibbling away little bits of his neighbor's lands. What made this especially effective was that he took the field nearly every year, year after year after year, and he tended to keep what he had conquered. It's been estimated that over the course of his lifetime, Charlemagne personally led no fewer than 54 distinct military campaigns. And through this methodology of gradual persistence, all those little gains in the end added up to a huge empire. So by the time of his death, his kingdom encompassed most of the modern countries of France, Germany, Belgium, and a good piece of Italy as well. It would in fact be the largest empire seen in Europe for the next 900 years. No European ruler would control more territory until Napoleon came along in the early 19th century. One significant difference between the sort of warfare practiced by Charlemagne and many of the other conquerors that we've studied is that these campaigns typically employed very small armies. So on his various military expeditions, the standard size of the Carolingian army seems to have only been about 8,000 men. And just think back to some of the epic battles of ancient Rome, India, and China, where you had forces of up to 100,000 troops per side. Now, to some extent, this disparity in numbers just reflects a general trend. As we move from the classical era to the Middle Ages in Europe, everything has become on a reduced scale. For example, whereas ancient Rome reached a population of around 1 million inhabitants, during the Middle Ages, it's doubtful that any European city ever got much larger than about 50,000 people. While maybe not as overtly flashy as someone like Alexander, Charlemagne was obviously a very competent general who won victory after victory in his never-ending sequence of small but often hard-fought campaigns. Given his overall record of achievements, it's maybe a little bit unfair that the most famous battle which is associated with him was actually a defeat. In 778, he led an army into Spain at the invitation of one Arabic leader to fight against another, and that expedition ultimately proved unsuccessful. But as Charlemagne and his army were retreating back across the Pyrenees Mountains, the rear guard of his army, protecting the baggage train, was ambushed by some local Basque tribes, and they were massacred. Now, in military terms, this was an insignificant, if unfortunate, incident. But it's attained fame all out of proportion to its importance, because this little incident became the subject matter for one of the first great works of medieval literature. And that's an epic poem called The Song of Roland. This tale was not actually composed until the 11th century, and it gives a very romanticized version of the heroic but doomed defense offered by the commander of this rearguard, Count Roland. And in the poem, the Basques are transformed into Muslims. Now, however inaccurate that poem may be as military history, it does nicely encapsulate important medieval values, such as the extreme loyalty displayed by Roland to his king. The warfare of the Carolingian era can also conveniently be regarded as marking the rise to dominance of the heavily armed and armored horsemen over infantry. And that's a trend that would culminate later in the Middle Ages in the figure of the medieval knight, completely encased in plate armor. If we turn to Charlemagne in the realm of politics, just as his cavalry-dominated army was a precursor of later things to come, so too the administration that Charlemagne established to run his empire prefigured elements of medieval feudalism. The basic government system, of course, was a hereditary monarchy, with the king, at least in the abstract, having total power. In practice, what Charlemagne did was to divide up his empire into roughly 300 administrative districts. And each of those was placed under the control of a lord. In Charlemagne's system, he was termed a count. Within their respective territories, each count was like a miniature king, responsible for ruling the territory and collecting taxes. Now, when summoned by Charlemagne, the counts were obligated to provide the king with soldiers to make up his army. And in certain frontier regions that were unstable or being threatened, he set up districts called marches, which served as buffer zones. And the counts were bound to the king by ties of personal loyalty. As you can probably guess, a recurrent problem throughout the Middle Ages would be counts and lords either trying to break away from their own king or sometimes setting themselves up as rivals to him. Charlemagne, though, seems to have been quite successful, on the whole, at keeping his counts loyal. And one strategy that he developed to aid that process was he set up a system of personal envoys who circulated around his empire. And so they functioned both to help the king keep an eye on what was happening in various districts and as a way for the local rulers to relay their concerns back to Charlemagne. These envoys were known as missi dominici, or literally messengers of the Lord King. And they always traveled in pairs, consisting of one secular noble and one member of the church. A third significant area in which Charlemagne's actions reaped him great benefits concerns religion. Charlemagne himself appears to have been a devout Christian, and he was always careful to cultivate a good relationship with the Pope and with the religious establishment. For example, at his own expense, he constructed and restored a large number of churches and other ecclesiastical buildings. And he encouraged his own subjects to tithe a part of their income to the church. At one point, when the Pope became entangled in this internal dispute at Rome, Charlemagne took a public stance supporting him. The payback for all of these actions came at a specific moment, and that moment was Christmas Day of the year 800 AD. And on that day, in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, Pope Leo III personally placed a crown on Charlemagne's head and bestowed upon him the title Charles Augustus, Emperor of the Romans. And in its symbolism, this little moment wonderfully captures the three main strands that had all come together to form the early medieval world. Because what we basically have is a Christian pope crowning a barbarian king and giving him a Roman title. So it represents how Christianity was the dominant religion in Europe, and that the former barbarians had become the established political powers, but also the most impressive title that they all coveted was still derived from the now long-dead Roman Empire. And beginning in the next century, it became traditional to assign a variant of that title to one of the kings of Europe. And this appellation was Holy Roman Emperor. And it's a measure of how powerful a grasp the image of the Roman Empire retained on the European political landscape that for the next 900 years, kings would scramble to be identified with the ancient Romans via that title. Just as no empire equaled Charlemagne's in size until Napoleon's, so too Napoleon would be the one to finally get rid of that long-standing title. This very public endorsement of Charlemagne by Pope Leo ensured Charlemagne's legitimacy, and it really helped to cement his identity as the preeminent king in all of Europe. From that point on, Charlemagne was indisputably the greatest leader in Western Europe. And other kings sent representatives and offerings to him to acknowledge his status. And so eminent had Charlemagne become that even the Caliph of Baghdad, who actually was a much more powerful ruler, sent gifts to Charlemagne. Among those gifts was a pet elephant who was reportedly called Abulabaz. Now, incidentally, the name of that elephant has provoked an odd degree of contention among scholars who cannot seem to agree on what the actual meaning of his name was. The whole thing is complicated by the fact that the recorded name is obviously some sort of mishmash or corruption of a number of Arabic words. But the three most commonly proposed translations for his name are, first, the rather unimaginatively literal, the elephant of the Abbasids. Second, the intriguing moniker, the father of intelligence. And finally, my personal favorite, a name that you could translate roughly as Mr. Wrinkles. Charlemagne apparently was quite pleased with his pet elephant. He seems to have enjoyed keeping it close to him, because we know that the elephant died while accompanying the king on one of his military campaigns. Finally, the fourth area in which Charlemagne made his mark was culture. Charlemagne was a generous and enthusiastic patron of the arts. And the result of all these efforts was that his time is sometimes termed the Carolingian Renaissance, meaning that there was a distinct flourishing of the arts, culture, and learning. And the focal point of all of this was the capital city that he established for his empire. This capital was the city of Aachen, which today is located in Germany. And Charlemagne and the artists and architects of the Carolingian Renaissance were very much influenced by, again, the model of ancient Rome. Indeed, Charlemagne himself liked to refer to Aachen as the New Rome. This admiration for classical Rome can be seen in the palace that he built at Aachen. And the city of Aachen, by the way, was an old Roman one that had been laid out on a grid pattern which was derived from Roman legionary camps. Charlemagne's main architect was a guy named Odo of Metz, and he retained that basic grid layout from the old Roman city, and he constructed a number of buildings within it matching those avenues. And of these, one of the most impressive, and in fact the only one that survives till today, was Charlemagne's chapel, which is called the Palatine Chapel. It was a fairly complicated structure, but at its center was a large, domed, octagonal space that was 50 feet wide and 100 feet high. And it was there that Charlemagne placed his throne. And the chapel was richly adorned with decorative marbles. It was equipped with gold and silver lamps and vessels and other things. At the other end of the palace from the chapel was the great council hall. And that structure was modeled after a Roman basilica. That building was 150 feet long and basically consisted of one big open hall. And this was where Charlemagne would hold official ceremonies such as receiving ambassadors from other countries. It was also the location where he gave an annual speech or address to his subjects. Nearby was another reminder of the old Roman past. There was a Roman bath complex in the city, fed by natural hot springs, and it was renovated for Charlemagne's use. A little bit unusually for the early Middle Ages here, Charlemagne was an enthusiastic swimmer, and so we know he took great pleasure in swimming around these baths. One source tells us that Charlemagne had the habit of inviting whoever was present to jump in and join him, and these might include family members, noblemen, but sometimes even his own bodyguards. And sometimes upwards of 100 people would end up cavorting in the waters with the king. Fueling the Carolingian Renaissance were the intellectuals that Charlemagne encouraged and actively invited to come live at Aachen. And these men came from all over Europe, and they included a number of the leading Christian thinkers of the day. Charlemagne was also very concerned with promoting education, and so he established a number of schools. Now, education at this point in time was mostly limited to clergy, to members of the church. And so the same was true of these educational institutions. One aspect of the Carolingian Renaissance that can be seen today in tangible form are the thousands of manuscripts that were meticulously inked by hand by Carolingian monks and scribes. And a large portion of extant Greek and Latin classical texts only survive because the perishable originals were copied by Carolingian monks during this era. So Charlemagne played an important role in preserving the legacy of antiquity for the future. The copyists of Charlemagne's time, though, faced a problem when it came to a material to write upon. So paper, as we've seen, was known in China and the Middle East, but that technology had not made it to Europe. Now, in the ancient Mediterranean world, people had written on papyrus scrolls. Papyrus is a paper-like substance which is made from an Egyptian plant. Problem is, now the Muslims have conquered Egypt, and in so doing, they cut off the supply of this very useful material to Europe. The monks, therefore, had to find something else to write on. And what they eventually settled upon were treated sheets of sheepskin known as parchment. Monks would spend hours laboriously making copies of texts of all kinds, but above all, they focused on producing copies of the Bible and other writings important to Christianity. And these manuscripts were not just intellectual treasures, but they soon developed into works of art. And this was because the monks would write in beautiful, ornate letters, which we now call calligraphy, and they would also draw little pictures or decorations in the margins of the text. And when you have a text with those sort of decorations, it's called an illuminated manuscript. And over 8,000 of them survive that were made by the hands of Carolingian monks. Now, as you might imagine, the finer examples of these manuscripts were very valuable objects, not just because of all the hours of skilled labor that went into them, but because the raw materials themselves were quite expensive. Here's a little bit of trivia. How many sheep do you think is required to produce one copy of the Bible in the sort of large size that was common at the time? Well, the answer is somewhere between 300 and 400. And a flock of sheep that big would have represented quite a lot of wealth in that era. Charlemagne's an interesting character, and he's somebody who exerted an important influence on all of subsequent European history. Later kings, especially in France and Germany, would look back to him as a model of the ideal king, somewhat in the way that later Roman emperors were always comparing themselves to Augustus, the first emperor. One of the main sources for Charlemagne's life is a biography that was written about him by a man named Einhard. Einhard was a courtier at Aachen. He knew Charlemagne personally. And so his biography gives the hope of gaining firsthand insight into the personality of this important historical figure. I should note, though, that Einhard's biography is very hagiographic in tone. He refers to Charlemagne as the noblest king, the greatest of all his age. And he's obviously giving us a little bit of an idealized version of Charlemagne. Some recent scholarship has challenged the veracity of various portions of Einhard's text, but nevertheless, it gives us some intriguing details about Charlemagne the man that we can use to kind of flesh out the portrait of Charlemagne the king. One thing that might have contributed to Charlemagne's success as a leader was simply his physical appearance. At 6'3" high, and that's a height that was confirmed by examination of what is allegedly his bones, he looked like a king. He was big and imposing, so he exuded dignity and elicited respect. Late in life, his hair turned white, and his coins will show him without a beard, but with a little curled mustache on his upper lip. And in addition to swimming and warfare, we know that he delighted in horseback riding and hunting, both of which are things that the Franks generally were expert in. And so, once again, we see the same link that we've seen a number of times in this course between hunting and royalty. So we first saw that among the Assyrians. In keeping with the idea that a good king must be a good warrior, and that the appropriate way to learn and demonstrate martial skills is by hunting, Einhard notes that Charlemagne spent a lot of his free time riding and hunting. And to ensure that the next generation of Carolingian rulers would share those qualities, as soon as his sons were old enough, Charlemagne insisted that they too practice horseback riding and hunting. Charlemagne seems to have taken a lot of pride in his Frankish heritage. We know, for example, that he wore the kind of native Frankish costume, which consisted of a linen shirt and pants. He had a bordered tunic, these sort of leggings, and an otterskin vest. And he carried his sword with him at all times. He evidently disliked both foreign clothing and clothing that was too fancy. And he would only dress up in his finery to please popes or on formal occasions. But most of the time, he was said to dress just like one of his subjects. Einhard also claims that he ate and drank in moderation. And his doctors urged him, for the sake of his health, to give up roasted meat, which was his favorite food, and he couldn't quite bear to do that, so he ended up ignoring their advice. While he plainly projected a tough, manly image, especially among the Franks, he also embraced learning and intellectual pursuits, not just as a patron of the arts, but also as a practitioner. So he was a skilled public speaker, always a useful skill for a leader. He made an effort to learn foreign languages, even though he may not have been always successful at that. He even seems to have acquired some understanding of Greek and Latin. And he clearly admired teachers of the liberal arts. He would go to their lectures. He liked to listen to history being read aloud as he ate his dinner. And even though he might avoid dressing like foreigners, he enjoyed befriending foreigners, and he would entertain them lavishly at his court. So, although he was proud to be a Frank, he also was careful to cultivate a cosmopolitan, worldly atmosphere around him. As we've seen many times with previous kingdoms, Charlemagne's great European empire didn't last long after his own lifetime. And once again, it really seems to have been just his personal charisma and his personal abilities that held that empire together. So, upon his death in 814, his son, who was called Louis the Pious, inherited his empire. But he turned out to be a pretty weak ruler. And when he died about 30 years later, the once mighty kingdom was chopped up among his three sons in a document which was known as the Treaty of Verdun. By the way, that document was written in three different languages, and those were early versions of Italian, French, and German. So we can already see that the modern linguistic divisions of Europe were beginning to take shape or form at this particular point in history. In more ways than just linguistically, and in more places than just Europe, the 9th century represents a pivotal moment in the formation of the modern world. And that is a topic that we'll consider in the next and final lecture of this course. Thank you.